So good evening. Just want to invite us all to continue just sitting in Zazen. You can receive this talk as you would anything else that comes up in your practice. Before we dive in, just a bit about this text that we read together called A Whip for a Good Horse. Torienji was a disciple and Dharma heir of the great Japanese Rinzai Zen teacher Hakuin Ikkaku. And he once wrote a letter to a samurai to encourage his practice. This letter is now known as A Whip for a Good Horse. This title can be confusing, maybe a little threatening, but don't worry, no whips here at Morningstar. But in the Dhammapada, the Buddha states, be like a good horse, touched gently by the whip. The horse moves forward with power and energy. Have an abundance of confidence, good conduct, effort, concentration. Be aware and attentive. Put aside this great mass of suffering. So the title of this reading is inspired by the Buddha's teaching, which invites us to be responsive in our practice in order to alleviate suffering. So in this talk, I will again weave in some passages from this reading. It's interesting, I have not generally written out my talks, but I've taken to this practice. James Ford, who was my first teacher, writes out all his talks, and I'm beginning to see why. At some point, your memory doesn't work quite as well. All the things start to fall out of your head. And on a sutra like this in particular, which has, or a reading like this, which can have so many different references, so I'm going to read this one for you. So in section 3 and 4 of his letter, Enji invites us to comprehend, quote, the root of all ignorance regarding our fundamental nature and the fundamental nature of reality. This ignorance regarding our fundamental nature causes suffering, so it's worth investigating. Enji invites us to deepen our investigation by asking ourselves, who hears, what feels, what cognizes, etc. In essence, he's bringing us into this moment and asking, who is hearing these words right now? We can call this inquiry practice. I've practiced with Huado like this, a kind of focusing question, dropping them into shikantaza for many years. So it's not really about getting to a final answer, you know, and moving on. We might imagine that we should answer these questions intellectually as well. We can use our minds to think about these questions, but I think that Enji is inviting us to use our eye of practice to explore what we are. When we think we know what we are, rather than getting caught up in the content of our thoughts, Enji invites us to ask, who thinks that? This way, we doubt the seer, doubt the hearer, doubt the thinker. We remain in a state of constant wonder. Who am I? For me, this is the heart of practice. This is why I called my blog The Wonder of Zen. In this practice of staying curious about what we are, we might notice senses of self arise. The Buddha taught that there are 6 levels of consciousness. These are the 5 senses plus the mind or thinking. In Buddha's model, senses of self are constituted by those 6 senses. Because of their importance, senses of self are described as the 7th level of consciousness in Vasubandhu's Yogacara. In this teaching, senses of self arise along with our 5 senses, thoughts, and the 8th level of consciousness, which is sometimes called our store consciousness. Whether we designate the sense of self as a separate level of consciousness is not so important, I think, but it is helpful to specifically identify senses of self because they're so important in terms of suffering. As discussed last week, the fundamental ignorance that Angie describes is our tendency to objectify ourselves and objects in the world as if they were separate fixed identities rather than inseparably intimate. We view the objects of the world as out there and our bodies and minds as me or in here. And this can lead to a sense of isolation, a sort of me against the world attitude that can feel quite lonely. As Ben Connolly summarizes, the Buddha taught that our tendency to objectify ourselves and the world causes us to feel alienated. It causes us to feel frustrated. We lose the things we want to hold. We harm people because we are trying to hold on. And we think we've got it all figured out, and they are wrong. We might therefore imagine that senses of self are a problem. But senses of self and conceptions of others actually also help us distinguish one wave from another in this vast ocean of being. This is the basis of healthy boundaries. We describe this capacity to distinguish this from that as the relative truth in the Dharma. And without this capacity, we might try to, eat cars or something. We could not survive. Our sense of self also sometimes offers helpful information for us, distinguishing what is beneficial from harmful. When I help students in my English classes, I might feel good about myself for a bit. That's not a problem. Then, as I did earlier this week when I was frustrated with a student, I might make a sarcastic joke. See my student's reaction, and I might feel a little bad about this. You get a dropping sensation in your gut. I can reflect on the precepts. I can apologize. I can vow to do better. Vows are deep intentions that help transform our habitual responses. Again, in the Yogacara, intentions, sometimes called impressions, they integrate into our store consciousness or our unconscious mind, which for now we might think of as our mind's past conditioning and the way it shapes our perceptions and habitual responses. So in the Yogacara, this conditioning is described as the eighth level of consciousness, whereas, Buddha referred to this more as karma. So again, we can think of it in different ways. This past conditioning goes back innumerable generations. This conditioning may sound like a fixed self. And now we're getting sort of connecting back, weaving back. This conditioning may sound like a fixed self, and we sometimes relate with this. Oh, I have these habits. I am this person, right? As if that's like a fixed self. But this is not the idea. In the same way that our body is conditioned by our experiences, so are our habit minds. We can be mindful of our tendencies, like my tendency to make a sarcastic joke when I'm troubled by someone. And then vow to be supportive instead. In this way, we plant new seeds that can ripen and grow. For me, the engine of transformation is our bodhisattva vows. Working mindfully with the precepts, we wake up to our harmful, habitual responses and vow to do better, softening our old habit minds and opening the heart, maybe just a little bit. Sometimes our past conditioning is really powerful, even frightening. We may have experienced some sort of trauma in the past. We might get triggered in the present. We might spin off into powerful, arguably disproportionate feelings of shame. One of the most painful senses of self that there is. We may not be able to distinguish this triggering event from the traumatic experience in the moment. The Buddha taught that suffering that is not felt thoroughly repeats itself endlessly. Zazen can offer space for us to feel and heal these old wounds. But sometimes we may also need support. We may need support from like a licensed therapist. My journey has included 5 years of therapy. Ultimately, different histories call for different skillful means, which is why in the Sangha we tend to consider skillful means personally during Dokusan, because we're all different. But the Buddha also taught that we cannot alleviate all suffering on the relative level of skillful means alone. In the same way that we can have some effect on the conditioning of our body, we can have some effect on the conditioning of our habit minds, but there's much that is also out of our control. Causes and conditions are endless. There will always also be old age, sickness, death, losing everything and everyone we love. Impermanence and suffering can taste like bitter medicine, but generate a sense of urgency in our practice, inviting us deeper into the way. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, "Any teaching that does not bear the Dharma seals of impermanence, non-self, and nirvana cannot be said to be the teaching of the Buddha." When we operate only on the relative level, we tend to chase dreams of happiness endlessly and become disturbed that we've lost, I'm quoting here some more just in case you can't tell, become disturbed that we have lost the original nature and wander through the 6 dispositions and 4 kinds of birth. That's a mouthful, but it's what we talked about last time in our discussion. These are the ways we're born into the 6 realms described in section 2 of his reading. To be free of this form of birth and death, Torienji suggests that we must break up the root of ignorance regarding our true nature. Hakuin, again, Tori's teacher, wrote that self-nature is no nature. According to Buddha, when we look deeply into what we are, we find no innate self. And we've talked about this before, of course. He called this anatman, meaning non-self. The Buddha described himself as a, quote, flowing occurrence, and challenged our notion of static selves. In looking deeply, rather than innate selfhood, he says that we find a flow of changing elements. There are no fundamental building blocks or first causes, only the flow of thoughts and sensations. Every cell in our body is replaced over time, even our store consciousness, our previous conditioning and karmic ripening, is modified with every new experience. There's nothing permanent anywhere. Reality and everything in it is fundamentally ungraspable. The water of the river is ever-changing, so from the perspective of time, we find non-self. This is also true from the perspective of space, as we have explored. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "The self is made of non-self elements." He's describing dependent origination. He likens the self to a rainbow. The rainbow is nothing without the non-rainbow elements of water, sunlight, air, the witness, the earth, on which the witness stands. It takes a universe to produce a rainbow. Senses of self also arise out of causes and conditions and shapeshift with every encounter. Look deeply into them to see that senses of self reflect relations. I'm only a father because I have children. Again, the point is not to get rid of senses of self. I think that's really important. We can actually appreciate them. When my children were young, being a father meant like speaking in high voices and chasing them around the yard. So I might have thought of myself as playful. Now that they're grown and have moved on, my sense of being a father is something different. I won't go into it. When things are going well with them, I feel, you know, like a wonderful dad, you know? But as any parent knows, we don't always feel like wonderful parents. Looking deeply into senses of self, not only can we learn to respond to situations more skillfully, but we can come to see that senses of self themselves are born out of ever-changing causes and conditions. Identity is not innate, but based in relation. This is the idea. Remove the non-self elements and nothing remains. Look into each flowing wave and we find the ocean. As Ben Connolly writes, letting go of the sense that we are a self experiencing things is the way to enter this mysterious, flowing unfolding. I like that sentence. I thought that was really well. I'll read it for you again. He writes, letting go of the sense that we are a self-experiencing things is the way to enter this mysterious, flowing unfolding. Because we all exist as this web of relations, caring for one another is caring for our own life. Recognizing our interdependence, coming back to the reading, we sport in the ocean of vows, which is a really weird way of saying it, but I like it. Caring for all beings as our own life. This is what it means to be a bodhisattva, to recognize that we are not separate, and to do what we can to care for each other. As James Ford Roshi used to exhort, hear the heart's call and do something. Zen isn't just about sitting on the cushion, right? It's noticing, paying attention, being engaged, responding. Having said all this, even non-separation doesn't capture the living mystery of it all. When we cling to non-separation as an idea of what we are, we can get lost in non-differentiation. Sometimes people call it being lost in emptiness. It's like they call it a hell cave. It's also true that each wave is a dynamic expression of the ocean, beautiful in its particularity. Sometimes we call this suchness, the bright taste of a lemon, a beautiful rainbow in a gray sky, a chirping fire alarm in the hall, clanging, percolating radiators in the night. Perhaps this world neither is nor is not. Like a dream. Honestly, attached to any notion of how things exist, and we lose touch with the visceral presence. No concept can capture the incomprehensible aliveness. At least none that I've ever come up with. It's like trying to capture the spring breeze in a bottle. There really is no last word in Zen. So the most important thing is, I think, is to just keep practicing. I think this is the heart of NG's encouragement. This is what I kind of, my takeaway. NG calls this progressive practice. We just take the next step, and in so doing, we give up these lesser enlightenments. As Uchiyama Roshi wrote, open the hand of thought endlessly. Sit still and ask, who hears, what feels, what cognizes? Ever wondering and allowing the mystery to respond. Eventually, we read, you return to the nature of all Buddhas. This is called fulfilling Buddhahood. And we can do this right here and now. In fact, it's already done. As Zenji's teacher Hakuin wrote, this very place is the lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. But what is it to be a Buddha? Thank you.